This is a lecture given at St. David's Episcopal Church in Austin, Texas. Visit our website, stdave.org.
All right. Hi, y'all. I'm really glad to be here and excited to be speaking to you. And I'm going to do a little bit of reading because not my own words, but words from an oral history project I did based on this period of time when Jews came into Texas. But before I start on that, I wanted to honor a close friend and colleague of mine who some of you may know, Debbie Weingarten, who passed away a couple of years ago. She was an incredible scholar of Texas Jewish history and poetess. And her mother, Ruth Weingarten, was also a phenomenal force to be reckoned with, who was a major scholar of Texas women's history and Jewish history. And Debbie wrote a book, a chapbook called There's Jews in Texas. And she grew up in Dallas. And I wanted to read this to you. I hope it doesn't hit you the wrong way, but I always like to bring Debbie into the room with me when I'm talking about Texas Jewish history. She's such an incredible force in my life. So this book, this poem is called Second Grade, Part Two. Being 8 years old means walking alone to the Skillern's drugstore at the Park Forest Shopping Center with my weekly allowance quarter searing a hole in my already sweaty shorts pocket. I know what I'll buy, the latest Superman or Batman comic book, whichever one came in that week and doesn't already live in the pile on my nightstand at home. With my new Superman comic slipped in the sleek paper bag top, carefully folded so my sweaty hands don't ruin my treasure, a grown man stops me on the sidewalk, eyeing my Star of David necklace and asking if I'm Jewish. When I nod yes, I'm not supposed to talk to strangers. He tells me that's really too bad for me, because didn't I know that Jews burn in hell when they die? Tears falling so hard I could barely see, I dropped my weekly treasure and ran home to Mom so fast I thought I might keel over before I got to her and be snatched right down to hell. When I told Mom what happened, she put both hands on my shoulders, knelt to my height where she could look square in my eyes, and in that Dallas drawl of hers said, "That's okay, honey. Don't worry. We're Jewish. We don't believe in hell." I'm glad you laughed. So there's Debbie with me. She grew up at the same time I did. I was born in the 50s. And as Father Braun said, a third generation Jewish Texan. I want to talk to you today about a moment about almost exactly 21 years ago, right after 9/11. My husband teaches 10th graders at our Sunday school at Congregation Agudas Chaim. I hear that some of you may have heard Rabbi Blumhoff last week, who's the senior rabbi at that synagogue. So every year, my husband takes his 10th graders to New York City for a Jewish heritage tour of New York City, and I usually go with him. So here we are on a cold, wintry day in March, almost exactly 20 years ago, at Battery Park, getting ready to take the ferry to the Ellis Island Immigration Museum across the way. The students' conversations are a little bit restless, as they are talking about, this is a memorial to 9/11, this thing in back of us, and we're talking about it, and they're nervous and scared and restless, reflecting the conversations of their parents about the fear of the terrorists who came into our country bombed the World Trade Centers and came here. And they're talking about how could they have gotten into this country? What happened to the kind of immigrants of our grandparents and great-grandparents? And why are current immigrants so different than our own? So this is a point in history that is unique, but it is also a point that has recurred generation after generation after generation. The immigrants that came before were good immigrants. The immigrants today are bad immigrants, and what can we do about them? So it reflects, here, come on, puppy. It reflects the us standing between the idea of America as a proud nation of immigrants and this fear of immigrants coming in. So later that morning, we get to Ellis Island Immigration Museum, and the kids all run to the line of computers looking up their family's heritage. And one kid comes sort of disgruntled up to us, my husband and me, and says, "Why are we here? I don't have anything to do with New York. My grandparents came through Texas and settled in Texas, and we're Jews in Texas. We've never been to New York." That was the moment, like many moments. So this is a pamphlet from the 19th century that again reflects the fear of immigrants coming in. But that was the moment, that was the genesis of an idea for a museum exhibit that I came back to Austin, came back to the Texas State History Museum, the Bullock Museum, and proposed to the director of the museum. I said, "I have an idea. I'm a native born Texan, and I didn't know that Galveston was an immigrant port into the nation, a major immigrant port, one of the top 10 immigrant ports. Why don't we do an exhibit, a temporary exhibit, about Galveston as an immigrant port into the United States?" So that's what we did. The idea of the exhibit was to raise awareness of Galveston as one of the top 10 transoceanic gateways to America in the 19th and early 20th century. Did y'all know that Galveston was a major national immigrant port? Yeah, so there you go. And then the second one was to use this little known piece of American history as a lens through which to explore current issues and attitudes about immigration today. So from Benjamin Franklin's tirades against German immigrants in the mid 18th century to the Chinese Exclusion Act more than 100 years later, to the Patriot Act put in place by Bush after 9/11, to Trump's attempted ban on Muslims, there has always been a history of tension over who we collectively regard as real Americans, and therefore who we should allow into the country and who gets to decide. Although immigration law was not part of federal statutes until the mid-1800s, this kind of debate over newcomers was a part of the national political and social discourse even before the Declaration of Independence. By the mid-1800s, nativist paranoia about undesirable foreign aliens was beginning to be reflected in changing immigration laws and increased restrictions at the gates. And by the turn of the 20th century, discriminatory attitudes toward alien foreigners were both constituted and reflected in a growing set of gendered, nationality, and race-based legal restrictions on who could enter the country. The Jews of Russia and Eastern Europe were one such group that came to be targeted in the first decades of the 20th century, with especially strict interrogation laws designed to restrict entry of those deemed unwanted or unfit to become American citizens. The United States had experienced a dramatic shift geopolitically and racially in terms of who was coming to the United States, from those Northern and Western blonde-haired, blue-eyed British and Irish immigrants to immigrants from Southern and Eastern Europe who were swarthy and curly-haired and different. As the commissioner at Ellis Island wrote in 1903, quote, "The present predominating immigration from Southern and Eastern Europe is inferior on the whole to the old Northern European immigration. It contains many undesirable and unintelligent people." That was William Williams, the commissioner of immigration at Ellis Island in 1903. And an American race scholar here in Texas, Fred McGee, an African-American named Fred McGee, goes on to say this, quote, "The change in attitudes in Galveston toward immigrants from other countries, particularly immigrants from Eastern Europe and places like it, I think you can't explain that without having as a backdrop what was going on in the South at this time in terms of race relations. Nativism rose, scientific racism grew. This idea that racial purity was being diluted by this influx of immigrants started to be the order of the day. Immigrants were thought to be non-assimilatable into what was the dominant pattern of race in Texas and America at this point in time. First of all, these people look different. They have big noses. They have curly hair. You know, everything about them is wrong. They speak funny languages. They're dirty. They're unclean. These people can't come here. They're not part of the American family. Immigrants were considered to be undesirable for a whole range of reasons, but mainly because they were not Anglo-Saxon white." That's Fred McGee. So in preparation for this exhibit, which was called Forgotten Gateways, Coming to America Through Galveston Island, I spent 10 years, literally, well, not 10 years, from 2002 to 2009, when the exhibit opened, working with immigrant communities here in Austin and throughout Central Texas, working with immigrant descendants in Texas, and doing a major piece of oral history by documenting the families of Jews who had come to this country between 1907 and 1914 as part of a immigration plan to save Jews from the pogroms of Russia and Eastern Europe and bring them to the United States through Texas rather than through New York, where increasing anti-Jewish, anti-Semitic sentiment was already settling in. So here you see one of my favorite cartoons from the early 20th century, a Puck cartoon of a new immigrant coming in and all of these rich fat cats saying, you know, stay out, and looking at the shadow of their ancestors who were all just as poor coming in, Irish and Jewish and German, et cetera. So this was part of the oral history. These were the two oldest people we interviewed, Ida Reed, who was 104 years old, and Al Sheps, A.I. Sheps, 96-year-old from Houston, who had come to this country as children on a steerage boat from Bremen to the United States. I interviewed Ida Reed. She was in a nursing home, and we did a oral history project with 10 states throughout the Midwest where Jews were brought when they came in. And Ida Reed told this incredible story of how she was a little girl when she came with her family from Bremen. And the boat, if one person was sick on the boat in steerage, everybody was sick if it was a contagious disease. And tuberculosis was one of the worst. And she remembers her little sister crying and coughing all night long, and her parents trying to shush her because there were medical inspectors who came through, and if they found that you might be sick, they would send you back. And they were trying to shush her. And then Ida remembered opening her eyes and seeing her family wrap her sister up and throw her overboard. She thought that they had thrown her overboard because she was too noisy and wouldn't shut up. So she was terrified. Only later did she realize that her sister had died, and that's burial at sea was what happened. Based on this plan, this original oral history project, we would put advertisements in Jewish newspapers all up the Midwest and invite people to come to tell their story. We would set up in a Jewish community center or something. People would come. And even though we just invited them to tell their story, they would come and bring the precious one or two objects that their parents had brought with them to the United States, like candlesticks for Shabbat on Friday. My great-grandmother and my grandmother, who was 2 years old, when 10 years old when she came, brought candlesticks, but she also brought a wooden, carved wooden bowl that's about this big that they use to make challah, make bread with every Shabbat. And I make bread with that bowl every Shabbat and started when my youngest son was like 4 years old, who is now, I'm proud to say, a baker of a bakery in Austin that was named by Yelp the best restaurant in Texas. So go check it out. It's called Paper Route Bakery. It's on East Cesar Chavez Street. So here were some of the one-page profiles we did with transcripts of these oral histories. And that's part of the basis of what I'm going to read to you today or talk to you about today. But I want to set the scene and the period of history we're talking about, which was a difficult time for Jews in Eastern Europe, in Russia, Poland, Lithuania, that whole area, which was known as the Pale of Settlement. At the turn of the century, many Jews were talking about immigration. They were talking about it in the same breath as they were sharing stories of the recent attacks by the Cossacks and the pogroms in the neighboring towns. Scholars talk about forced migration to flee from death, from pogroms and mass killings as impelled migration. You have no choice but to leave. And this was a quote from one of the people that we interviewed. Once there was a pogrom in our town and we had to run. I said to my mother, Ma, why? We're such good people. Why are they killing us? My grandmother, the same one who came when she was 10 years old, remembers the Cossacks coming through her town on horseback. My grandmother was eating an apple and they grabbed the apple out of her hand and ate it and took it for themselves, which is what she remembers. It's a lot better than taking her or killing her. But some people also left because they feared being conscripted into the army. Here's one person who says, why did I come? Basically to run away from army service. It was a waste of human life. They would go into the army. They attempted to have them lose their Jewish religion. They received no education that they could use for future life. And the period of army service was infinite. Here's a picture of Velvel and Hannah Navit, who were radical activists in Russia at the time. They were at a workers' rights meeting in Minsk and recognized that they had to leave. The Galveston movement was founded by a wealthy railroad baron in New York named Jacob Schiff, who dedicated $10,000, which was the equivalent of several million dollars, to save Jews from Russia and bring them to Galveston because it was already a port of entry and it was not New York. So there was a whole immigration service set up to advertise Galveston in Europe, to bring people into Galveston, and then to contact businesses throughout the Midwest that might need somebody. Well, I need a shoemaker. Well, I need a tailor. And greet people at the gates in Galveston with a card that says, here's an employer who needs a shoemaker. Take the train to Kansas City or something like that. It was called the Jewish Immigration Information Bureau. This was a someone that we interviewed who had a picture of himself in the army. People were also beginning to hear about Ellis Island and the increasing anti-Semitism in Ellis Island, which was, of course, the largest point of entry. Here's someone who said that they eschewed Ellis Island because they were afraid that they might be sent back or detained at Ellis Island. So if they could, they would try to make it to Bremen in Germany. And there were dedicated ships that came to Ellis Island, Galveston. Here's, you can see an advertisement for a ship line from, this is Hamburg, that also went straight to Galveston. And this was the sort of passport carrier that people would bring with them. This is the a story of Sarah Bernstein, who tried to come to Galveston, who made it all the way to Bremen. But once she was in Bremen, she was inspected by the medical inspector and found to have a very common eye infection called trachoma. But you cannot enter the United States with trachoma, and so she was sent back. So instead of her coming, her father came with the money that she had and then later brought her. This is a medical inspector at Ellis Island who's inspecting for trachoma. And remember, this is the very beginning of the 20th century. Nobody knows about germs too much. So they would take an instrument that looked like a crochet hook, or maybe even a crochet hook, and they would flip your eyelid up with it. And if it was red underneath your eye, that was an indicator of trachoma. And then you would be detained or sent back. But here's the medical inspector. He had a cloth on his belt. He would flip that thing up and then he would wipe it with the cloth and then he would flip up the next one. So it was not a very good practice. So one of the things that happened was that legitimate diseases like trachoma and tuberculosis combined with racist and anti-Semitic sentiments, and medical inspectors started deporting more and more Jews if the medical inspector happened to be anti-Semitic. So for example, in Ellis Island, there were many, many medical inspectors. In Galveston, there was only one head of the medical inspection, and he sent back seven times as many Hebrews as were sent back in other ports of entry for things like bent back or hernias or minor things like that. But not only did he send them back for things like that, but he also said, "I also cannot refrain from inviting attention to what is really a very important and inadequately considered phase of the defect mentioned in the sufferer. These immigrants are still within their reproductive period and may reasonably be expected, if landed, to become parents of native-born citizens. Insane, idiot, imbecile, feeble-minded, epileptic, and neurotic persons are by no means all descended from persons suffering from the name mental and nervous affliction, but it is rapidly becoming appreciated that the germinal elements are profoundly affected by this disability." So it was a kind of scientific racism, a kind of eugenics that said, even if you're not afflicted with these elements of imbecility or idiocy, your children will be. And therefore, this particular inspector general wrote a letter. This is from a letter to the Surgeon General of the United States requesting that no more Hebrews be allowed into the United States. Well, in any case, we can be glad that that didn't happen. This is a young immigrant who, like many who came to the United States, like many immigrant groups all over the place, they take a job doing whatever they can do when they perhaps don't speak the language or don't have that much education. This was a young man who took a job selling bananas, and he would sell bananas from door to door, finally gaining enough money to get a little horse and buggy, finally gaining enough money to perhaps get a storefront and then a shop, which he did. This is the trachoma. I think I'm going the wrong way. This was the inspection card. And the inspection card, every single day, the medical inspector on the ship would inspect people and give a hole punch if you passed the inspection. So people, this was Sarah Bernstein's inspection card. People were very anxious to avoid the medical inspector if they had a cough or anything else. So here's A.I. Sheps, the guy that I showed you a picture of before, who came here as a young boy. He got tuberculosis on the ship. His parents, he was one of seven kids and they were all on the ship. His parents were very anxious to avoid inspection of the medical inspector. And his sister, each of the little kids was taken care of by one of the older kids. And his older sister wrapped him in this blanket when he was 4 years old on the, so that they couldn't see, actually, I'm sorry, he didn't have tuberculosis, he had measles, so that they couldn't see the spots on his body. And when he was in his 90s, his older sister gave him this blanket and said, this was the blanket you were wrapped in. And this blanket was in our exhibit. So here's the center off of Galveston where people would be detained if they had tuberculosis or something before they were sent back. And here's an arriving ship. One of the other things that happened was that in the late 19th and early 20th century, there were laws on the books, again, to try to prevent all of these Southern Eastern Europeans from coming. And one of the laws was a law about against prostitution. So, okay, what does a prostitute look like? What does a prostitute look like who might be coming through? Any ideas? Well, a prostitute doesn't have to look like anything other than a single woman traveling without a husband or without a family. So single women were frequently detained and sent back, especially single Jewish women. For example, in the port of Galveston, again, six times as many single women were deported, sent back than at other gates because Jewish women, because of this particularly anti-Semitic medical inspector. So there's a great story of a very famous rabbi in Galveston who you may have heard of named Rabbi Henry Cohen. Henry Cohen was a rabbi in Galveston for, I don't know, 65 years or so. And he met every single ship that was coming in and acted as a translator, a Yiddish language translator, for the people who were coming off. And one time there was a woman on the ship who was coming to meet her fiance. These are in Galveston, there was not a formal immigration center like Ellis Island for a long time. So the center was in a cotton warehouse. This is a group of Jewish men who've just arrived. And the second man on the left with the hat is Henry Cohen. Yeah, wait a minute. Yeah. So here are some of the people waiting for their inspections. And this is one of the classes of potential exclusions: idiots, imbeciles, feeble-minded persons, epileptics, insane persons, persons with any type of insanity, paupers, and persons likely to become a public charge. So this was a real catch-22, paupers and persons likely to become a public charge. Likely to become a public charge meant somebody who was going to be poor and was going to be on the public, on the government's dole. So you had to come into the country with some money. At least $25 was the popular idea, but you could not come with a guaranteed job from an employer in the United States, because in Texas, when the Capitol was being built, they didn't want to use formerly enslaved African Americans in the 1880s. So they hired Swedes from Sweden to come to help build the Capitol. Labor lawyers acted against that and established what was called an anti-contract labor law, because they thought it was impeding from employing local people here. So there was a law in the books that said you could not hire somebody from Europe and already have a job. So there was a little bit of a catch-22. You couldn't have no money, you couldn't have too much money, you couldn't have a job, but you couldn't also seem like you were going to become a public charge. So this was a drawing from the exhibit where we start talking about some of those issues. And this is another cartoon that I love, because here's Uncle Sam, danger to American ideas and institutions, holding back, trying to hold back the flood of riffraff who were coming in from Europe and Eastern Europe. And you can see that they all look like bad communists, anarchists, et cetera, et cetera. Wait a minute. Here's a guy, Charlie Hoffman, who came in. And when he came, his name was Zalman, and it soon got changed to Charlie. Here's Henry Cohen. All right, so here's this woman whose name is Ida Feld, who comes to meet her fiance, who's come earlier to establish a job, named Sam. She's traveling by herself. She's just about to go into the inspection room and be interviewed, interrogated about why she's here by herself, and just about to be sent back. Henry Cohen hears word of this. He comes up onto the boat. He brings Sam Feld, who has come down to the docks to meet her, up onto the boat with him. He grabs Ida and he marries them on the spot, on the boat, so that she can leave with Sam. And here's the guy who started off with a few bananas peddling on the street, and now he's got a store. And one of the things that you'll find is that in the late 19th century, after the Civil War, the railroads started being built all throughout, the Transcontinental Railroad had already been built, and the railroad started being built all throughout Texas, frequently with Chinese labor. The Chinese had been brought from California after they had finished building the Transcontinental Railroad to Texas to build these railroads. And all along the railroad route, people would settle, and Jewish families would settle from one stop to another to build a little dry goods store. One of the issues, another one of the laws that was put in place against Jews from Russia was a law of anarchism, trying to prevent people from coming. So here's someone who said, let's see. The purpose is to keep out the undesirable foreigners, which is a laudable object to conserve the welfare of the country. This is a newspaper article. The impecunious and criminal classes and all aliens afflicted with contagious diseases should be barred from making the United States an asylum. So, another illegal category was that of anarchists. Some Americans were concerned for the increasingly popular communist ideology in Russia. This law mandated that immigrants who were admitted denounced any anarchist tendencies. But really, it was an underlying law that congressmen passed to try to keep out the large influx of Jews that were coming into this country. There were 10,000 Jews who came through the Galveston movement, but over 3 million Jews who came in this period from the late 1800s to before World War I from Eastern Europe. Because Jews were active in speaking their mind against unfair labor practices and would speak out and quickly be labeled an anarchist trying to overthrow the government and then be sent out. So when you came in, you were asked a question, are you an anarchist? And if you said no, which everybody did, and then later you were found at a strike or something, you could be put in jail, not only for being an anarchist, for inciting revolt, but also for lying on your paper. So one person said, my father, unfortunately, spoke his mind usually. And on his citizenship papers, he wrote that he was a socialist. And the judge who looks at it when he was giving him test of whether he should pass or not, and he said, how do you expect for this country to become socialistic? Are you going to have a revolution? And my father said, no, we have the best system. If people want it, they'll vote for it. If they don't, they won't. And that's it. I have to pause for a moment. One of my grandparents, my grandmother, none of whom came through this Galveston movement, came to New York when she was a young girl of 16, and she got a job at a factory that made clothes. And she raised so much hell about the labor working conditions in the early 20th century and caused the women to strike. And they struck for several days. And the employer, this is the way my family folklore goes, whether it's true or not, I don't know. The employer called people together who were striking and said, look, we will meet your demands of increased wages and time off on one condition. And the condition is that you don't let Sarah Dochen back into the factory. Sarah Dochen, my grandmother. So I'm very proud of that. So here is the Jewish Bureau of Immigration card. And you can see hundreds and hundreds of immigrants upon first arrival in Galveston. And this is Haskell Harlech, who was the banana seller, setting up the dry goods store. There is a play that Haskell Harlech's son wrote called The Immigrant that you can buy and was performed on Broadway even not that long ago. And it's all about this family story. Here's the story of David Hoffman, who ultimately married Sarah Bernstein, the woman that we saw earlier. But apparently it was a common custom that when you landed in the United States, you get your picture taken at one of these booths and send it back home. And in Texas, when you landed, you could put on all kinds of chaps and cowboy hat and get your picture taken. Well, David Hoffman had been groomed by his father to be, he was a yeshiva boy, to be a rabbi. He didn't want to be a rabbi. He wanted to come to the United States. So he agreed to marry a very wealthy older woman who would give him the money to come to the United States, and he would send for her later. So here he is on the day of his arrival, and he is taking a picture, and that woman is the woman who he had agreed to marry. So he takes that picture and he goes about his life. And then he meets Sarah Bernstein and falls in love with Sarah Bernstein and ends up never marrying that woman and bringing her over, but marrying Sarah, and they have a whole life here. Here's a ship's manifest, which is just a document of everything on a ship. And here's Zali Hoffman, you see, coming from Europe. So my favorite story, and this is a story that I'll end on, is a story of a guy whose family, whose parents and other siblings migrated from Russia to Israel, to Palestine, as it was known then, and they were going to send for him later. So he makes his way to Bremen, to Germany, hoping to catch a boat to Palestine, to Israel. And he asks somebody, is this the boat to Palestine? And they say, yeah, sure. And so he gets on the boat and he ends up in Galveston, and he says, well, where is Palestine? And they direct him on a train to Palestine, Texas. And there he ends up for the rest of his life. But this moment was a moment that we're not, unfortunately, done with. It was a moment of strife about who we let into our country and who belongs, and tremendous stereotyping and discrimination based on race and religion, but mainly race, about who can be an American. This is a pamphlet from the Ku Klux Klan from 1917, when the Texas State Fair had a special day at the fair called the Klan's Day. And on that day, all Klan's members in Texas got in free. And the Klan's members included men, women, and children. And they were very excited to see the knight, I think it's called the knight of the Klan, who came with a platform called The Menace of Modern Immigration. Oh, didn't mean to do that. Anyway, and on that platform, it wasn't about anti-Black sentiment. It was about keeping out all of those un-American immigrants who are anarchists, socialists, communists, et cetera, which is a shortcut for both Jews and Catholics coming into the United States at that time. And it ultimately ending in one of the most racist laws that the United States has ever passed, which was an immigration bill passed in 1924, commonly called the Quota Act. And the Quota Act was a law to restrict the numbers of people who could come into the United States. Well, there's nothing wrong with that, but they decided to restrict it based on a quota, a percentage of all of the nationalities of people who were already here in the United States. And the percentage was 3%. But it had only been recently that all of those Southern and Eastern Europeans had come into the United States, Jews, Catholics, peasants from the Mediterranean. So there's a census that takes account of everyone. It's every 10 years. This law was passed in 1924, but instead of using the 1920 census, when 2% of people from Russia would have been a whole lot of the undesirables, They finagled it to use the 1890 census before Jews had started to come in. And that was the law that was passed. And that law, which also, by the way, excluded all Asians and all people from Africa, that law was not off the books until, any idea? Until 1965. When Johnson signed in a new immigration bill that overturned the idea of people coming in based on race or nationality. So they were coming in based on family or work or things like that. And that's why we had a huge influx of Asians, Africans, et cetera, after 1965. So I'll leave you with that and open it up for questions if you have them.
A good friend of mine from San Antonio, her name is Robbie Ravis, but her grandmother was Frances Rosenthal Callison. She was inducted into the Cowgirl Hall of Fame. She's the first Jewish person to be so inducted. It looks like she might have immigrated a little bit earlier because she was born in 1908 from San Antonio. And if you remember the story, there was Callison's "Where the Working Cowboy Buys His Duds," which I loved as a child. Like, I couldn't spend enough time there. So I have some great pictures of her and her horse and everything.
I know that story. And in fact, the woman that I mentioned earlier, Ruth Weingarten.
Sure. It was really a comment. And I guess this is not going. I'm going to turn around, guys. So, hi, it's Laurie. I was just telling Susie, or just commenting, really, a good friend of mine from San Antonio, her grandmother, who's Frances Elaine Rosenthal Callison, who was Jewish, was inducted in 2016 into the Cowgirl Hall of Fame. And I have a picture of her on her horse. And it was a big deal. Like, my friend was gathering information and sending emails to all of us, you know, to find pictures or whatever. But they had a store in San Antonio, you all may remember, it was called Callison's. And their motto was, "Where the working cowboy buys his duds." Which is kind of fun. Anyway, she was a little bit, looks like she was born in 1908. So probably her family immigrated a little before this time. It just, a little fun San Antonio, Central Texas history. So.
There were actually a lot of Jewish cowboys and a lot of stories about Jewish cowboys. And of course, there were a lot of Jewish cowgirls. I love that she was inducted in 2015. What else? Well, I wanted to thank, go ahead.
And I'll stand here. It's not projecting. We were driving to East Texas and stopped in Forsyth Glen and noticed this beautiful building with green onion domes, which was the synagogue, and now it's the community center. So I was just curious about the community in Forsyth Glen, and very sadly, apparently, there is no longer a community there.
So Corsicana, thank you for asking that question, was one of the small towns that was settled by Jews who came through the Galveston movement. And there were also some earlier Jews who were more German Jews who had come into the country earlier, who settled in Corsicana. And the first thing that Jews do whenever they come to a place is not build a synagogue, but build a cemetery or a space for their loved ones to be buried. But the second thing they do is to build a synagogue. And there is indeed a beautiful synagogue in Corsicana, as well as many small towns. And many of these small towns, the Jewish community has left, Schulenburg, Brenham, et cetera. In fact, just 3 or 4 years ago, there was a really beautiful old synagogue from Brenham, Texas, that had been caretaken by the last Jew in Brenham, Texas, and was moved from Brenham to Austin, Texas, and is now on the Dell Jewish Community Campus. There's a synagogue that worships there, an Orthodox synagogue that worships there, but you should go see it. It's just beautiful. But yes, there are small synagogues all over these towns. There's We have a small house in Fayetteville, Texas, between here and right near LaGrange. And there's several Jews buried in LaGrange. There used to be a pretty large community in Schulenburg, right near there as well. Yep. Yeah. You know, Orthodox Jews or observant Jews who keep kosher and have their meat cut and blessed in a certain way. In Austin, and there's a particular person who does that. In Austin, there was no such person. There was a lay rabbi who took on doing that, and there was no place. And so he reserved a little space in a Mexican grocery meat market in East Austin, where he would cut the meat in a particular way and bless it and serve it to his congregants. Yeah. Right during or just before World War I. In 1917, of course, people stopped coming during World War I by boat, and it really shut down at that point. I mean, there still were people coming through, but many fewer by boat. And same with Ellis Island, really, too. Ellis Island, I don't know if any of you have been to the Ellis Island Immigration Museum. It's quite extraordinary, but it was essentially abandoned from the 1930s to the 1990s, I think, when it was renovated to be a museum. Well, I thank you so much and really appreciate it. It's an honor.
You can find more lectures and sermons on iTunes by searching for St. David's Episcopal Church in Austin, Texas, or visit our website at saintdave.org and click on the podcast button.